Podcasts from the South are a series of conversations created and hosted by Maria de Guzman at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Claudia Millan at Duke University. Today's session features Salvadoran, Guatemalan, American photographer and illustrator Veronica Melendez, who is coming to us from Washington, D.C. Melendez has been featured in venues such as Remezcla, Me Too, and NPR's Alt Latino for casting light on Central American artistic production in the D.C. metropolitan area. She is co-founder of La Horchata Zine, a seasonal publication printed and bound in Washington, D.C., which promotes Central American artists. Melendez's communal forms of artistic production are also evinced through her pop culture sensibility. Her digital illustrations project, entitled Iconic, is informed by the familiar logos, graphic representation, and typography that bring Latin American staples to life. Her series, Le Pido a Dios Que No Me Olviden, or I Ask God They Don't Forget Me, won the 2018 Award for Documentarians of the American South. This prize is conferred by the Archive of Documentary Arts, part of Duke University's David M. Rubenstein Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Melendez's visuality juxtaposes Central American everyday lives at the center and at the margins of power, their displacement under gentrification, and their invisible labor. She exposes underexamined questions on how Central Americans in D.C., which is generally conceptualized as a northern city, also fall under the Nuevo South framework and its social-cultural dynamics, ushering in important contexts about the remaking of place and diaspora.
Hey, Veronica, welcome. Could you start us off just talking about your formation as an artist, in particular, a Central American visual artist in the D.C. area?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I started photographing around 2006. I first got into it after having a sports injury, actually. I used to play a lot of soccer, and I tore both of my ACLs, and I needed another form of expression, or I just needed another outlet for relaxation and de-stressing, and I found that through photography. I started going out to the immigration protests that were happening around that time during the May 1st, like May Day protests in D.C. So I'd ride the metro out into D.C. and photograph a lot there, and that's kind of how I started finding that perspective and that voice through photography, which then eventually led me to seek out an arts degree at the Corcoran. And so I definitely started off my arts sort of like trajectory in life with the motivation of just kind of documenting or shedding light into this community that I found in D.C. that I felt like wasn't being represented enough in art.
And is there anything D.C. specific in terms of how you ground your work visually? You just said protests. I don't know. They happen ostensibly anywhere, of course, but I'm thinking about D.C. in particular as this politicized community.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I definitely... the protests that I'm referring to weren't just, I guess, protesting other... It was mostly protesting immigration rights and, like, advocacy for immigration immigrant communities. And I guess a lot of the things that I centered my artwork around became focused on the Central American community within D.C. Having grown up in that community, a lot of what I saw every day was sort of... little bits of home for my parents within our household, or the foods that we were eating, or the stories that I was being told. And I guess my artwork was really much influenced by all of that, like that upbringing within this like very strong Central American community in D.C.
And in terms of D.C., could you tell us a little bit more about what it's like or what it was like to inhabit or what it is like to inhabit various D.C.s? I mean, on the one hand, you were doing this art that was connected with, for instance, immigrant rights. But on the other hand, you were also at the Corcoran. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of synchronicity or the multiplicity of being in these different spheres and perhaps, I don't know, some of the cognitive dissonance that you might have experienced and what you make of that and how you dealt with it, in fact, in your art?
Sure, yeah. I mean, growing up in the part of... I grew up in Wheaton, Maryland, which is right outside of D.C., in a high school that was about, like, 80-something percent Latino or Latinx. And going from that space and being around like art students in that space that were all also kind of like children of immigrant parents creating artwork with that mindset. And then I went to the Corcoran, which is mostly like a white student body. I had like one other Latina photographer that was with me throughout the entire 4 years I was there. And
how large was your entry class?
I know that when we graduated, there were 60 of us. So it was really small. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time I was in a school where there were more than maybe four Latinos in the entire student population that I knew. And so I wasn't used to that type of, mentality. And also a lot of the students that I did interact with came from other places in the country where they had sort of the reverse experience that I had growing up, going to a very diverse high school. They had maybe no more than two people of color in their high school, you know, and then they were now in D.C., which is, you know, a more diverse city than they had ever experienced. And we were all in this one school, all creating art together. And it was a bit of a rude awakening to what, like, other parts of the country are like, I guess. And then also then, you know, I created a lot of my artwork in undergrad revolving around my parents' experience living in the D.C. area and immigrating from Central America into D.C. And so a lot of my artwork is informed by their experiences and having to share those experiences and inspiration with my white classmates was also really an interesting experience that I had to keep going through even into grad school as well.
I remember speaking to you earlier last fall, and you mentioned something about growing up in Wheaton and having the largest subway stairs in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, yeah.
There was something really curious about just Wheaton in general in terms of your formation, and I wondered if you can speak a little bit about that. And the second anecdote that I thought was so curious was that your parents met at some school.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about school formation in how these migrant populations meet. Just your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So my white classmates in high school would refer to Wheaton as Little Mexico, even though there is not much of a Mexican population in that part of Maryland. It's mostly Salvadoran and Guatemalan. But this part of Maryland, like, was referred to as some of my teachers as well as somewhere where they would just drive through and not be too like frightened to like get out of their car to like get gas or something, which is interesting now seeing it's being gentrified now and there's all these condos being built right by the metro station there now, and now it's the place to be, which is blows my mind. But growing up in that area, it was like, it still is to me this bubble of this little like Salvadoran Guatemalan bubble of a community that I luckily never felt othered within my own Latino community, which is something I now realize I was so fortunate in. But it seemed to become this place where you would almost find like a middle class within the Central American community, mm-hmm. which I think is very special because other parts of the DMV, I don't think you find that many homeowners that are Central American. So that's something that I also grew up around, like the idea that like, oh, all my aunts who came here from Guatemala, they all own houses. And that's like such a privilege and a special thing to have happened. So growing up around that idea that we aren't all like living in these apartment buildings that the state has built for us as lower income residents to live in. But yet in this part of the DMV, people are owning homes like that. I think that was very special. And something that I think influenced me later on in life as well. Yeah,
that's great. Your parents about how they met. If it was at a school.
Yeah, it was at the Carlos Rosario. I think it's like the English school. So you go and you learn English there, and it's become almost infamous within like the DMV, where like a lot of parents or a lot of people have met at this like English school, and it's very like this iconic English school. My parents met there. And
so this iconic school where you learn English mm-hmm. and become sort of the site of these new Central American mestizajes of sorts.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. fantastic.
Yeah, I think every person that I know that's around my age, I'm 29, and their parents like have gone through that school as well or have some sort of relation to that school or have friends that went to the school. Everyone just knows about the school, and it still exists now.
It's very
still there.
Cool.
Yeah.
I don't recall exactly how I encountered your work, but it was definitely through Instagram, one link leading to another. I was just wondering if you had any comments or observations about how Instagram maybe has helped disseminate your work or the kinds of interactions that you're having through Instagram, because it seems like the iconic series, and your Orchata zine are very much in tune into this realm of social media.
How it operates. So I started the account with my artwork, my illustrations on it, just one day, just randomly had the idea of drawing the Maseca drawing, and I threw it on Instagram, didn't really think much of it. I was mostly doing photography at the time, so I thought, oh, I'll start this other Instagram just for my illustrations, just so I don't mix them with my drawings, and I don't, like, cross, like, interdisciplinary, make an Instagram. I just wanted them separate for whatever reasons. And then it just kind of caught on. It caught more attention than I thought it would, which is interesting because I never studied illustration in at all. And so the fact that my now illustration Instagram account was getting more attention than my photography Instagram account was kind of interesting in itself. But yeah, the Instagram platform has become a way for me to share my artwork, as opposed to just having it live as like a completed body of work within my website. Mm. So I like the idea of being able to just finish a drawing and put it up there and just getting like, it's definitely instant gratification of just getting responses right away for a piece of work that you just finished, which I guess there aren't many other platforms out there that will give you that, you know? And throughout all of art school, I definitely was told not to do that. It's like, they definitely frown against putting a body of work out into the world without it being completely done. But since I feel like this is something that is just ongoing and I will keep doing this illustration project for as long as I can, you know, because it's something that I'm constantly inspired by, just not only drawing products, but also family members and old found photographs. It's something that I just want to keep doing. So I don't ever really seeing it as completely done. So I don't feel as bad as just putting it out there whenever I finish one. I have found a lot of community that I thought I didn't even know existed out there through Instagram, and that has been really great. With the zine itself, though, that we definitely intentionally started our account on Instagram as our means of finding community and finding an audience and getting the word out there about our zine. We found it as the most approachable way to do it. Although now we've ventured into Twitter and also Facebook, but we don't really do much of anything in either of those things. I don't understand Twitter. But Instagram, I can get behind, and it's easier, I think, an easier platform.
Twitter is so hyper, such a hyper-condensed culture.
Yeah. I don't know, it's kind of scary. I'm like, the app, I don't know, I missed the Twitter boat, but...
So I'm very interested in the question of the zine, for example, because it seems like listening to your experiences, your formative experiences, that you're in a position to really evaluate how culture is produced, right? How cultures are produced, particularly as a first generation here in the United States, thinking about how your parents met at this school where they were supposed to learn English and what sort of social formations and cultural formations come out of that particular encounter, which might not have even been calculated by the school itself. So how is the zine a place where a certain kind of culture making is taking place, and how is it different or similar to chapbook or, you know, the other things that you might have been taught in art school, and how you're modifying those for your own ends, like, for instance, not being concerned about putting your work out before it's all done? Like, what are the different codes of values that are at stake for you, and also how does that relate to a different project that you're actually engaged in that's perhaps not what was taught at art school?
I definitely feel like my venture into the zine world was almost like sticking it to the art school world, and definitely intentionally, but more so than I thought that it would become, because I definitely feel like all the rules and like the strict structure of like this is what you're supposed to do, this is not what you're supposed to do in like a printed publication form, kind of go out the window with the zine. You know, it's more relaxed. I think just because we call it a zine, it becomes the stakes are less high, or you're allowed to do whatever you want, you know? Even though in the end it's really just a little mini magazine, you know? And so just the fact that we call it a zine instead of like this arts publication magazine, just give it a bit more flexibility, which I think then becomes more approachable. And within this community of Central American creatives, which I've tried to find through making the zine, maybe that's more an appealing way to get them to share like their artwork and their creations. You know, it's not the stringent, stiff publication. It's like, no, it's just a zine. Like, I've had people reach out and be like, oh, I don't have a finished body of work, but I have these really amazing photographs and I'm still working on it. Like, is it okay if I submit it even though it's not done? I'm like, yeah, like, please send me your work. Like, it's fine. And it's like amazing stuff, you know? And if it was just more of this like sort of unreachable arts magazine, they would maybe think otherwise before submitting something that's not completed and has like a whole concept behind and like, you know.
And then we might never see the work.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
in which case your little zine is not just a little zine. It's doing something, many things. Yeah.
But it's great because it's trial and error and brings you really into this bold terrain of not knowing who you're going to find. Have you heard anything from Central Americans themselves in the Isthmus?
Yeah, we actually, we've gotten a lot of submissions from people in Central America. We've had some from Belize, Costa Rica. Just recently, we found this connection with these zine makers in El Salvador, and then they submitted this round to our zine. And so I'm hoping to... I would really love to connect the creatives from the diaspora here in the United States to the creatives in Central America and just have, like, I don't know, all of us connect somehow.
But yet I also know that you're thinking about larger questions about Central American or Latinos, Latinas, Latinxes in the world, and Montreal and Scotland, for instance. So would you like to expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I recently discovered the Central American community in Montreal, and that definitely just blew my mind, and I want to know everything about them and just their experiences as, like, a reflection of, like, just how I grew up as a first generation born and raised in the United States and how people have grown up there, first generation born and raised in, like, French Canada, you know. I would really love to know their experiences and just, like, you know, how English was my second language, you know, after I learned Spanish, and just was French theirs or was it English? Like, I just want to, you know, it's the fact that there are bodegas up there with all the same products but just written and translated into French. I think that's really interesting and something that I hope can be explored more deeply.
Absolutely, yeah. When you think in this country how little we know about Canada, or we study Canada, or, you know, being in an English department, I'm always amazed that we don't have courses, more courses. I mean, some English departments have courses in Canadian literature, or in art departments, it's sort of the same thing. And so it's very interesting that you're embarking on research in Canada, but through Latinx experiences, and specifically through Latinx Central American experiences. I mean, that's a very complex and interesting project. Yeah,
I hope to actually do it.
Talk to us a little bit about your series Le Pido a Dios Que No Los Olviden.
Que no me olviden.
And how it now it's archived in the Duke University Rare Books and Manuscript Library.
Yeah.
And speaking to you earlier, I was just reminded about this whole idea of Washington, D.C. is this particular southern empire of sorts, and the ways that you take this Central American visuality in a part of the nation that is generally seen as black and white in a lot of ways. So talk us through your intent behind this art project and also how it is now being housed here at Duke.
Sure. So the project is called Le Pido a Dios Que No Me Olviden. And that title to that work comes from this small little book that sort of like a little journal that my mom brought back with her from Guatemala that she's carried with her since she's been here, since she was 18. And so within this little journal, I found all these goodbye letters from her relatives and friends and boyfriend and just anyone that meant something to her in her life as an 18-year-old in Guatemala saying goodbye to her. And these, like, really heartfelt, really sad, and sometimes hopeful and happy, you know, send-offs to her. We're all in this little journal. And reading one of them, I found a letter from my grandmother's brother, where he wrote, like, Le pido a Dios que no me olviden, which translates to, like, I ask God that you don't forget me.
Or that they
forget you. Yeah. And so I feel like that really, it kind of struck me, that phrase, and it just really, it stuck with me, and it felt like it was this, is coming from, like, just Guatemala in itself, like, asking Guatemala, asking all the people leaving, you know, just to not forget it, not to forget their country. I don't know where they come from. It kind of felt like that. And then I kind of got, that inspired me to just photograph like our everyday and our, what we, like how we exist within Washington, D.C. through these photographs and how we make the city our home.
And there is a dual direction of home here in Central America and in D.C. And it seems that this act of not being forgotten is equally twofold. On the one hand, it is Central America, of course, as we're discussing. But on the other is this home or the act of being forgotten at the very doorstep that has produced this Central American presence in the United States, and especially the nation's capital. So what is really exciting about your work to me is that it's historicizing subjects and a presence that can't be easily erased, not only from a visual archive, but their own physicality.
Claudia, can you give us an example of how you see this working out in Veronica's work?
Sure. I'm going to include both of her series here, Le Pido a Dios Que No Me Olviden, and Federal City. I don't remember each picture individually that I'll summarize, so I'll do it kind of thematically. It seems to me that in Le Pido a Dios Que No Me Olviden, Veronica moves from a very intimate, domestic family portraits of her grandmother and family members to community storefronts. We see the Virgen de Guadalupe. We see other kinds of iconographies in these other public spaces. By the time we get to Federal City, we're seeing more of DC's brutalist architecture at work, juxtaposed with small brown or dark brown bodies who maintain these particular spaces. We see workers in cubicles, we see cranes signaling displacement, as well as I believe the continuous forms of gentrification that are taking place in the area.
And all the ironies too, because the gentrification is literally in some ways dependent on the labor of these small brown bodies that appear in the work. Veronica, can you give us an example of how this manifests in your work?
Yeah, what comes to mind first is this one photograph from my series, Federal City. It's of this man who's standing on the top of these stairs, and he's kind of engulfed by all these buildings around him, and he's actually cleaning the stairs, so he's like sweeping the stairs, and he's looking back at me and he's smiling, but you can just make out his smile within the shadow that he's in, which I think is just that image of him becoming part of the landscape. I feel like it's very symbolic for me, because I feel like as a Central American community in Washington, D.C., we are very much like this backbone of D.C., whether or not people realize it or not. Mm-hmm. We're definitely still there, and we have been there, and we will continue being there. And even if we are being displaced within our communities in D.C. proper, mm-hmm. We're still there, you know, and we're still working in the city.
So considering all this, tell us more about the pioneering Melendez project and just how you took control of the means of production.
Sure, yeah. I mean, as a first generation born and raised in D.C., I guess I just became tired of waiting for someone else to do this for me, to start a magazine that features artists like myself, along with another friend of mine, Kimberly Benavides. We both just became increasingly more frustrated with the primarily white male-dominated art world, specifically in arts publication. A zine like this, as far as I know, does not exist, and I think it's become even more increasingly needed in our current political climate to create these spaces for other people like ourselves to be able to submit our artwork and have a platform for other people like ourselves to find it. And just specifically with the zine, we've had people from places like Oklahoma or other parts of Florida and just places where I didn't realize there was a Central American community, or maybe a Central American community does not exist. That have found the zine and have found their own like sense of community through our zine. And that's just this beautiful product of creating the zine that I didn't even realize was going to happen. For me, it came primarily just to find other people like mm-hmm. us out there, because I knew we had to exist. It couldn't just be a handful of Central American creatives that I knew in D.C. There had to be more of us. And just creating this little kind of humble publication has really created this platform for everyone to like kind of find each other and build a sense of community, even if it's just via the internet in a zine. You know, I think it's something that's really beautiful that has happened within that arts world. And just every time we do have an open call, since the second issue that we put out in 2017, we've had over 100 submissions from people all over the country, and not just this country, but we've also had submissions from Canada and Berlin and within actual Central America. And I think it's just great that we're all finally finding a sense of community within an art, like a printed arts publication, which I think is something that hasn't really happened before within the Central American creatives community. And I would hope that the zine reaches beyond the Central American community to anyone who cares about our stories. I mean, that's the importance of art. It creates an archive of all of our experiences. Mm-hmm.